Sairam, dear listeners, and a welcome to the heart of spiritual universe, Prashanthi Nilayam, at our Radio Sai studios, where it is a very cool and comfortable wintry day. And it is with great joy in our heart that both of us, Prem and myself, have gathered at the lotus feet of our dear Swami for yet another afternoon satsang. And this is a very interesting satsang because the topic is the satsang itself. This is going to be a satsang on satsang, and I'm sure that this will be very educative, enlightening, and at the same time informative, because as both Prem and me discovered, satsang is a differently understood word. Different people understand it in different ways, and the way Swami defines satsang is something magnificent and so beautiful, so simple yet so beautiful. All this will be the subject and content matter of our satsang today. So welcome all of you for this satsang on satsang, and as always we begin by placing our most humble and loving salutations at the lotus feet of our dear Swami. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind. And as you said, it's an interesting topic indeed. Satsang, we've been going through so many satsangs, and we are all part of a satsang for more than 2 years now. But we never spoke of what is the importance of satsang, though we might have made passing remarks and references to it. But to look at it, split the word and do a dissection of what Swami means by good company and what Swami means by satsang, I think it would definitely be a very educative process.
Because when we actually say the word satsang, see, for example, our Thursday live show is called as the afternoon satsang. Even in our school days, in college days, when there's any speaker who is coming to speak and share his or her experiences with Swami, we call it as a satsang or a parayanam. So it so happens that when we use the word satsang in our day-to-day language, it means a talk or a discussion or a kind of study circle on divine and spiritual matters. But with a little more knowledge, if I can say so, or understanding, as you said, if we split the word into sat and sang, sat is goodness, and satsang therefore becomes good company. So in that sense, we realize that speeches and talks and study circles on spiritual topics is just one way of satsang, one way of keeping good company. Good company is a very broad term, and it would be wrong to restrict it only to spiritual talks and spiritual discussions and meetings. But definitely spiritual talks and spiritual discussions and meetings are part of satsang. So we realize that with a little more knowledge, especially of the Sanskrit language, satsang is something broader than just discussions and talks on divine spiritual matters. And as we shall see in the course of this satsang, the scope of this word satsang is going to broaden and deepen at the same time.
You know, the need for satsang is, I think, it's universal. You need not be a spiritual aspirant to really see the need for satsang. But I think it becomes even more necessary and even more pertinent when you're in the spiritual field. And I think Swami has mentioned it so many times before. One thing is when we seek satsang, and the other thing is when satsang happens. You know, sometimes people have the ability, like Swami would often give this example of, you know, when the rishis and all used to set up their ashram in the forest. Those animals which by default would become domesticated in those ashrams would without their volition actually get satsang. Swami would talk about the deers and the other animals which would be taken care of by the women in the ashram. Without their knowledge, they would get satsang. And even when it happens without a conscious decision, it helps in the progress of that soul.
Speaking of animals and satsang and things happening without one's volition, I am reminded of this interesting experiment. I don't know if we have mentioned it in some previous satsang, but it's definitely worth mentioning again now. This was an experiment which basically shows what is the power of company. Swami says in his discourses, tell me your company and I shall tell you what you are. And at sometimes we may think that this is a kind of an oversimplification or a kind of a generalized sweeping statement. But its truth is actually demonstrated in this experiment. This was an interesting experiment devised with monkeys. What they did was they placed 6 monkeys in a cage.
Okay.
And in that cage, there was a bunch of bananas hanging at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And a ladder which had been placed, which was the only way to reach the bananas. Now, monkeys being monkeys, they are attracted to bananas. So, as soon as the monkeys were put in the cage, one of the monkeys, the most dominant among the monkeys possibly, climbed up to pick a banana. And when it climbed up to pick the banana, what the researchers did was to splash the other 5 monkeys which are on the floor with ice-cold water.
Okay.
And you know, it can be a very shocking experience to get splashed with ice-cold water.
Especially monkeys are not very fond of water anyway.
Exactly. And they're apes and humans are the only animals that are born without the ability to swim. Every other cat, dog, hippopotamus, giraffe, zebra, every animal, when it's born itself, it has the ability to swim. So for some reason, apes and humans don't have an... Yeah, so... Now when this happens, the monkeys are intelligent, they learn quickly. They realize that when any monkey is going up to pick up the banana, we are getting splashed with some... We are all getting a very unpleasant experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because of repetition of this act 2-3 times, what happened was the next time any monkey climbed up to pick a banana, the other 5 monkeys would gang up upon this monkey and pull it down. Not allow it to take the banana, because if this monkey touches the banana, the other 5 of them are going to get a bad experience. So this became established, and therefore came a time when, though there is a bunch of bananas hanging on top and a group of hungry monkeys below, none of the monkeys attempt to go and take the banana. Because if any monkey tries, the other 5 monkeys are going to gang up on it. Now what the researchers did was to pull out one monkey and replace it with another new monkey. A monkey which had no idea of what's happening. This new monkey came in and naturally it was attracted to the banana. The minute it started going to the banana, the other 5 monkeys ganged up on this monkey. This monkey did not understand what is happening. But it soon learnt that this is the way, this is the norm in this cage society. Anybody climb this ladder, you have to drag them down and smash them up. Then they replaced one more old monkey with one more new monkey. Again, this new monkey tried to go up and the 4 old monkeys and the new monkey, all the 5 ganged up. This new monkey had also learned, you know, I got thrashed, so this is what it is. One by one, they replaced the monkey's frame. And then they found that there were 6 new monkeys, which means new monkeys in the sense that none of these monkeys have ever been splashed with cold water. But even then, when any monkey would go up to climb and take the banana, the other 5 monkeys would thrash it down. Monkeys are considered to be very intelligent among animals and possibly closest to human beings. Here it shows that even in an intelligent animal, the effect of the company is so strong. The effect of what everyone else is doing is so strong that you no longer use your own brain, no longer use your own kind of rationale or thinking or instinct or whatever. You just follow what the group is doing. That is why, you know, company is so important. And that is why Swami says, keep good company, because tell me your company, I shall tell you what you are. If your company is good, you are good. If your company is bad, you are bad. If your company is mad, you are mad. I think there is no need to anymore emphasize on this fact that one's company is of paramount importance.
The another thing, if you look at it, the reason why the human beings tend to congregate in communities and societies, you know, the anthropologists, when they studied, they found among the mammals, one of the most ill-equipped to defend themselves were actually the Homo sapiens. You know, they did not have the claws, they did not have the scary teeth or the horns to fend their, those who would attack them. So it naturally became a choice for them to congregate and form small groups. The moment they started forming societies, the moment they started forming small communities, that led to their, defense being stronger. So they cannot defend themselves as individuals, but the moment they started forming these groups, then they started becoming more secure. So in a sense, that was what led to forming these communities. And the moment these communities started forming, you know, there is a nature for every community. There is a certain trait that every group carries. So that started becoming an overbearing thing on an individual. Like just like what you said about that monkey group.
And you know, the beautiful thing over here is, while forming societies and communities is not a unique thing among humans only. Many animals do it. They live in groups because there is security in groups, and even though they have claws and horns, it is still better to have multiple claws and multiple horns. So, while living in communities is not something very unique to humans, what is unique to humans is that they can choose to either be part of a community or dissociate themselves from a community. Suppose I am part of a community, I can just choose that, you know, I don't want to be part of this. I shall go somewhere else. Animals don't have that. If they are born in that part, in the Masai Mara, for example, in Africa, you are part of that gazelle group and you will be a part of that gazelle herd. You just don't choose that, you know, I will leave this gazelle herd in Africa and let me go in Kenya and let me go to the gazelle herd in Nigeria and join them. It doesn't happen like that. That is why the importance of company comes so strongly when it comes to humans, because humans have the power of choice. We have the power to choose our company, and that is why we are advised that we should choose well and choose good company, choose satsang, because tell me your company, I shall tell you what you are.
And the other thing is, you know, when you talk of societal living and community living, you know, the need for being a part of that group, the need to be one among that gathering, we otherwise call it peer pressure. You know, you want to do things which is commonly done in that group. You want to do things which is a norm in that particular, you know, congregation of men or women, so that you be a part of that group. You know, that's what pushes most adolescents today to, you know, do wrong things or
in do the right things also.
Exactly. I mean, that is what satsang is. But, you know, exactly what we call peer pressure, we often use the word peer pressure very negatively. You know, we say that is what leads people to take to wrong methods of finding joy in life. But it is actually the same peer pressure, this ability to get swayed by peer pressure, in a sense, which is a weakness. That same weakness is what is going to be, you know, utilized or transformed as a good quality when you put it to satsang. Because when you know that there are certain things which are good, but you don't have the individual will and power to do it yourself, you get into a community where everybody does it and you're comfortable doing it there. And even if you are not ready to do it, you know, that desire to be a part of that group or to be, desire to be normal, you know, most often that's...
Be accepted by
right,
the group.
Except, I think all of us, except for a few, you know, that's why we have used the word mavericks. Most people want to do what most others do. So, you know, that is a quality which is used when you go into satsang. Because I remember, you know, once when I was in, I think, second or third year, one of our teachers came into the class and...
you're undergraduate.
Right, undergraduate. One of our teachers came into the class and he played a bhajan which Swami had sung in the thing, and he said, let's sing along. Imagine, it's the middle of a class, we are in the university, and suddenly the teacher comes and plays the cassette and he says, let's all sing along. And he was singing loudly, following whatever Swami was singing. But you could see that, you know, there was a little bit of uncomfortable smiles and giggles going around, and boys were not following. So immediately he paused the cassette and he looked at us and he said, if you cannot take the name of Swami, the name of God, in a gathering like this, where everybody does it, and where doing it is not something weird, if you don't have the courage to take Swami's name now, you will never take it ever in your life. Because what you are saying is, here, you know, Swami has given all the conditions. You do not have to hesitate to do the right thing here, because the conditions are given and a peer pressure group is created where you will do the right thing by default.
When you say this point, Prem, 2-3 things come to mind. Let me just list them out quickly. The first thing is, yes, this is something that we should never be ashamed of or shy away from, because Swami would often exhort in his discourses, when you can sing film songs aloud, when it's played on television and people dance to the tunes, why do you feel ashamed to dance to the tunes of a bhajan? Why do you feel shy in singing aloud the name of the Lord? What you are doing is actually purifying the entire world, and you should be proud of it. And that kind of pride in chanting and singing the Lord's name can come only when you have conviction in the Lord's majesty and power, and complete faith that the one who is controlling this universe, the only one who matters in this universe, is the Lord. And therefore, it is only when we have such kind of a faith will we be able to comfortably sing aloud or chant the name of Swami. That is one point that came to my mind when you said this. The other thing is, as you said, the teacher was saying that if one is not able to do it in a system like this, one won't be able to do it anywhere else. That brought up this point that, see, we are lucky to be a part of a system where what is good and what is bad is defined. Even if one is not in the system, or one, if suppose one happens to be in the Sai fold, more or less there are some broad definitions of good and bad. But what, how does a person say who doesn't know Swami, or who is just a normal person, average person in the world, who is not in any special system, if he wants to join good company, how does he distinguish what is good, what is bad? I mean, that is a question that comes up in mind when, if I have to choose a good car over a bad car, I always want to choose a good car. But I should know the parameters which define a good car and what is a bad car. In the same way, if I want to keep good company and avoid bad company, how do I judge good company? How do I know what is good, what is bad?
Very true, because you know what you said is very pertinent, in the sense, when you talk of good company, when you talk of satsang, it is not only for the spiritually minded, it is even for day-to-day living. You know, a person who might not know Swami, who might not be in the spiritual path, heading towards a divine goal, but nevertheless, good and bad is a part of everybody's life, and it is important to stick to the good, for not only for the individual's sake, even for the society's sake, you know, because that's what keeps a society healthy. Is made of individuals. So it's very important for everybody, first of all, to know what is good and bad. And if we were to go by what Swami says, and of course we are going to go by what Swami says, but giving that as an opening argument, Swami says that you always know what is good and bad. The problem lies only where what you choose to do. Are you strong enough to do what is right? And Swami always says that you know what is good and bad. If anybody says that I don't know what is right and wrong, I think he is lying, or he is not looking deep within.
Exactly. Swami would often say in his discourses, the body is a water bubble, the mind is a mad monkey. Don't follow the body, don't follow the mind, follow the conscience. Even as he would make the statement, it was evident that Swami has taken for granted that everyone has a conscience. And if God is taking something for granted, it means it is granted, because He is the one who grants everything. So everyone has a conscience. And as you rightly put it, everyone deep within knows what is right, what is wrong. And that is why there is guilt when we do something wrong, and there is a kind of inner joy when we do something right. And that inner joy is not completely wiped out even with others' criticism. And this inner guilt is not completely wiped out even if 1,000 people praise us for that deed. So the judging, that is the conscience, is always within each and every one of us, and therefore, as you rightly put it, it would be wrong, it would be delusion on one's part to say that I actually am unable to discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad, because human being is defined by that ability to discriminate. And in fact, Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he emphasizes, he says that he is in creation in three different forms.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the forms is the conscience. He says in the beings, in the living beings, he is there as the conscience. The other, of course, is his presence as the pranashakti. Pranashakti which differentiates the living and non-living.
Right.
And the other thing is just the power inherent in the atom. You know, the atom of any element can be split to produce a massive amount of energy. That energy is God. So that is the most primary level in which God is present. If you go to a slightly higher level, that is at the level of pranashakti. That is what differentiates a stone and a tree from a stone, life force. So the second way in which God is present, Krishna says, is as the pranashakti or the life force. And a very special manner, which is present only in human beings, not in any animal, not in any tree, not in any other living form, is that as the conscience. So when Krishna says he is present in all the humans as the conscience, so there is no question of saying that one is unable to distinguish between right and wrong. It boils down to having the courage and having the willingness to follow what one's conscience tells one as the thing that is right.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is the very pretext of satsangam. You know, especially when you go into a group, let's take the scenario of somebody who's a, you know, who's a student who's getting into a college course or something like that. You might not know what is, you know, spiritually beneficial and spiritually harmful, but you know what is good and bad. You know, when you've gone there, you've spent your parents' money, you've gone there, you know what is good, what you owe to your parents. You know what you owe to your family. And you know why you're there. And anything which takes you away from what you understand, you know, it doesn't have to be somebody telling you what is good and bad. Even in your own understanding what is good and bad, I think if a person is able to list down and say that, this is what is good for me, this is what is bad for me, based on what I'm doing right now, where I am right now, I'm a student now, or I'm a working professional now, that which enables you to do more of what you have listed down as good is satsang for that period of time. Anything that takes you away from doing what is good or makes you do what is, you know, harmful at that point of time is wrong company for you that time. I think that's the simplest way of defining good and bad company.
Exactly. As you put it, you know, at that particular point, if I am a student, I have to study. So if before the exams, I have my friends who come and tell me, come on, let's go to a movie, versus a group of friends who say, would you like to join us for a group study discussion? I know how much of money my parents have put in, how much of their hopes and aspirations lie on me. So at that time, automatically I will feel guilty if, you know, I go to a movie and if I fail later, and if my parents feel bad about it, I will definitely feel very guilty. It's not the failure that is making me feel guilty. Now just imagine I had gone and joined the study group and I had studied well, I might still end up failing. But you know, that time when my parents are feeling sad, I can tell them that, mom, dad, you know, I tried my best, I'm sorry, I feel very bad to see you crying, but I tried my best, I just couldn't pass the exam. Compare that with a scenario when you're gone and enjoyed watching some movies and you have failed. With what face can you tell? You know that even if you tell the same statement to your parents that, you know, dear mom and dad, I feel very bad when you feel bad. That might be the truth, that you're feeling bad, that they're feeling bad. But when you say that, I tried my best, this is all I could do, something will poke you from deep within. It will just not allow you to keep a straight face as you say this, unless you're a hardened criminal. You just will not be able to, and you will know that what you're doing is wrong, and the only way you can become light at heart is to possibly break down and tell your parents that, you know what, I want to actually make you happy, but that time I couldn't resist my temptation, I went to the movies, I'm so sorry. And then yeah, possibly your parents will say that it happens, but come on, you know, you should focus, and you promise them that never again will it happen, then alone you'll feel lighthearted. So this ability to distinguish between good and bad, it's not some special ability. Even a person who is considered wicked, like Duryodhana, he had it. And Swami narrates the episode where he confesses to Krishna, to Krishna, that Krishna, you don't tell me what is good and bad, what is right and wrong. I know what is right and wrong. It's just, I know what is dharma, I know what is adharma. It's just that I'm unable to control my mind or my senses or whatever and stick to the path that is dharmic. That is why I'm doing adharma. I'm not doing adharma because of my lack of knowledge of dharma. And, you know, they say God always forgives one's mistakes. Why is this? I feel at times that this concept of karma has come in only because God has already given you the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. If Duryodhana did not have the ability to know what is right and wrong, and if he's doing wrong, that will not be called a sin. That will be called a mistake because he did not know. But the concept of karma comes in because most of the times when we do wrong, it is not like a mistake. It is just our inability and lack of focus to stick to what is right that we go on and do what is wrong.
You know, just going back to the scenario where you said that when you don't do well in your exam, you know, quite often I think we get into a certain amount of self-delusion, you know. We really don't know whether we have tried enough, or we really don't know whether we are, you know, lying that we tried enough or we really did. There's an interesting, there's an episode, we've spoken about it. There is the debate between Shankaracharya and Mandana Mishra.
Okay.
You know, where they have debate on their two different schools of philosophy, Advaita and I think Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa or something like that. And Mandana Mishra's wife, Ubhaya Bharati, she is put as the one who is going to see who wins the debate.
Judge.
Right? You know, what she does is, she takes two freshly made garlands and puts it on their necks, one on Mandana Mishra and the other on Shankaracharya. And she says that whosoever garland, you know, fades and dries first is the one who loses. You know, this might be something very mythical and, you know, something fancy about it, but the simple logic behind it is, you know, one of the scholars who speak about this incident, he says that actually what happens is, when you get angry, your body produces more heat. When your body produces more heat, the flower on you're wearing fades away faster. And only a losing man always gets angry. The man who feels that by his argument and by his honest argument, he's not able to win the argument, the temper starts raising. So very often, you know, you would see that when you need temper and anger to justify yourself, I think it's a very good sign to know that there's something wrong. You know, there's, if you look within, maybe there's some flaw in you, which you're trying to hide.
Extrapolating this same argument, when you need any of the six vices, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, to justify your position, that shows that it's in the wrong. That is why these are called as the six enemies of man. So, I think it's quite amply clear as to there is this vibrant conscience which distinguishes good and bad. The question that now comes, it is more or less been answered, but yet we will pick up that question and answer it completely, is that if it is the Lord who is present as the conscience in each and every one of us, why are we so different in our nobility and in our ability to do good? This is possibly another automatic rational question that arises when we speak of everyone having the equal ability to discriminate between good and bad.
Right. And I think a little bit of thinking will give us the understanding that though people may be born equal, there is a some point of time where there it changes. Like even if you look at it in a small family where, let's say, you know, a pair of twins are born, boys or girls, you know, brought up in the same family, being
identical twins,
go through the same schoolings, you know, the same parents, the same moment, the same type of conditioning. But still you feel that based on the choices which they make, based on what they choose to do, how they choose to behave, if you see maybe at the end of 17 or 18 years, you would find that they too have become so different. So even though that, you know, people may be created same, I think
the choices they make,
yeah, as the journey goes, the choices they make, the things they choose to do is what defines their personality after a few years.
The example that you gave of the two twins, in fact, that is the substratum for many movie plots where there are identical twins. One goes on to become the hero, one goes on to become the villain, one becomes the bright side, one becomes the dark side. Of course, that is one extreme of this. But as you said, the choices that one makes and the way one leads one's life results in apparently differing abilities of one's own conscience. And see, when we speak about conscience here, conscience, Swami says, remains with you across births. It is not only restricted to the actions that we do in this current birth that determines our ability to discriminate good and bad. It spans across lifetimes. I remember once Professor G. Venkatraman in an awareness class, he was explaining very simply, and this analogy made a nice profound impact on me because it felt so easy to understand. He said that the conscience is like a speaker which is embedded within you, and it keeps giving an output, it keeps shouting out what is right and what is wrong. And he said that every time you listen to what the conscience says, when you have the courage to follow it, the speaker starts getting louder and louder. And every time you decide to let the advice of the conscience pass and not obey it, it's like you have put one blanket over that speaker. Every time you disobey your conscience, you keep putting one by one blanket over the speaker. Afterward, it's not as if that the conscience is not speaking. It's that you're not able to hear it because it's been covered under a thick, you know, thick layer of blankets and mattresses. So what is, at such a point in time, definitely, one is unable to hear one's conscience, the other is able to hear it clearly. And Professor G.V. went on to say that if you want to hear your conscience after that, you have to start again removing the blanket one by one, and removal is by following the conscience. So first of all, you have to withdraw from all other noise. And here noise is not just the physical noise, but everything, the influences, the thoughts, get away and in solitude, in silence, concentrate and first hear what that speaker is saying. And then with all courage, follow what your conscience says, then one blanket would be removed. Keep doing it again and again, all the blankets would be removed till you come to a time when you feel that you have a vibrant conscience. The conscience is always speaking. Depending on how frequently and how intensely we follow it or not, its volume and voice gets louder or weaker. So, though the same Lord is present in all of us as the conscience, a lot depends on the choices we make.
And I think, in a sense, that's what describes the dynamics of the mind. Because if you look at it, we took the example of two children being brought up in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
How many times we've seen, you know, you see sometimes a 2 or 3 year old child, in fact, even younger, let's say a 9 month or 1 month old. There'll be one 9 month old child, 9 months old child, which might, you know, be very friendly. You know, you go and the child would go to anybody, you would be always smiling. But then you will also find a 9 months or 10 months old child who would be so attached to the mother and would not come away from the mother. Anybody who tries to come and try to, you know, play with it.
He or she will wail.
They'll start wailing. I mean, there is a very clear characteristic even in a child which has not yet started exploring the world.
Hmm.
And if you say that you've started making choices and the choices that you made has made your path, but you can see a difference even before the choices are placed in front of you.
Hmm.
You know, there is a certain amount of, as you said, some kind of luggage that they carry from the previous birth.
Some residual.
Right. So, in a sense, to be able to see that conscience better or to hear that conscience better, I think a process by which you are going to remove these past influences is very important. I think, and that's what spirituality is all about. Some of you often use the word vasanas.
Wow, okay.
The tendency that you carry.
Now, Prem, what you said made me feel awesome because I felt some bulb glow within, but I don't know if I could catch it correctly. Let me just repeat.
Mm-hmm.
Just correct me if I'm wrong. So, when we see babies at such a young age displaying such variable behaviors, though they are brought up in the same environment and though they are twins, for example, it shows that it's not just the choices of the baby made in this birth, because there is something that is residual within each of those babies that is making them react or behave in one manner. Is that right?
Right. I think we can understand this better if we, you know, go through what Swami says about the mind, the four aspects of the mind. Of course, it's from the Vedas. And
okay.
Swami has spoken extensively about it.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the functioning of the mind, you know, the mind is divided into four aspects. They say there are four aspects. I think we've all heard it. Manas,
Buddhi chitta, and Ahankara.
Okay, Manas is supposed to be the most fundamental part of the brain, where it's like the functional brain or it's the working brain.
Working mind
or the functional mind.
Okay.
You know, it just does. Like suppose you see something, like suppose you wave to me, this mind says you have to wave back. Something like which is more spontaneous and which has to be done, or you're walking, you run a thorn, that mind which says that you have to squeal immediately. You know, that which does not involve much of thinking. It is just a reflex, what has to
be
done.
A reactive mind.
What has to be done at that moment. You know, at that particular critical moment, what has to be done. The other one is the buddhi, which is the intelligence or the intellect. When we talk of seeing what is good and bad, what is
so
right and
wrong.
So this
is the discrimination.
The discriminating mind, the buddhi. And this is what actually listens to the conscience and says that, you know, it chooses between the conscience and the worldly choice which is in front of it.
Okay.
So the buddhi is the one which is doing that discrimination part.
So if I may interrupt you here,
right?
The manas, which you said, the functional mind, so it is like a kind of a lower clerk who keeps taking decisions for most of the things. If any problem involving little decision making comes in, it has to refer to the buddhi,
right,
which will discriminate and give the whatever the things to be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then comes, you know, ahankara is of course a completely different one. That is what actually kicks in the duality aspect, that which makes you believe that you are this body or this mind or this personality. That's the subtlest part of the mind, you know, because we all our functioning is based on that. You know, even doing good is based on your ahankara only. You know, believing that I am so and so making this decision, I am so and so is choosing to be in satsang. So it all depends on that ahankara. So that's the subtlest part of the mind, which comes last, which is dealt with last.
So the manas is the grossest part.
Manas is the grossest,
and then comes ahankara is the subtlest.
Right.
After manas comes buddhi. And then
comes the chitta, which is the most interesting thing, especially when you're talking about company, when you're talking about doing good, or, you know, listening to the right things. Because the chitta is almost like that hard drive which keeps storing all the informations of all the experience that you go through. Like, in a sense, I mean, even the simplest of things. Let's say that I make friends with somebody who's a person from Africa, South African friend I have. And I have a very good experience in having that person as my friend. So somewhere in my mind, there's a residual thought that South Africans are good people. You know, it's our friendly people.
So, are you suggesting that chitta is a place where what Swami calls as vasanas are all stored?
Right, that is the one which stores all these things. So it stores this, you know, small piece of information, so it is good to have friendship with South Africans. You have some other unpleasant thing. So there's another generalization which again gets stored in this.
So, and when we say vasanas, dear listeners, it is not just the tendencies and impressions that we have gathered in this lifetime.
Right.
It spans across different births.
Exactly. And that is why when Swami says you have to give up your animal nature, when you say vasanas, it even includes these animal natures.
We were animals in the past.
Right. We were animals in the past, if you look at it that way. So even those qualities are there. That's why Swami says that you have to remind yourself that you're not an animal, you're a man. And I mean, these are all processes by which you are actually clearing this hard disk of the impressions which it has already collected.
Okay, interesting. Now, you said, so chitta is like this hard disk which has got impressions from previous life births. And you said that this is related to satsang. So how is that?
Exactly, because when I said the buddhi makes choices, this buddhi constantly refers to this chitta. It says, okay, what is your past experience? In a situation like this, what are you supposed to do? It actually has to take command from the conscience and the chitta, but this chitta is so overbearing. In a sense, this chitta kind of becomes like a veil between the conscience and the buddhi.
Aha, and that is
so
why...
So that kind of colors your idea of what is right and wrong.
And that is why Swami emphasizes and says that any sadhana you do is for chitta shuddhi.
Exactly.
Or purifying the chitta.
Right.
Making this veil non-existent or transparent. So once the chitta gets cleaned of all past tendencies and vasanas, it becomes transparent and allows the conscience or the decisions of the conscience to freely flow through to the buddhi, which can then transmit it to the manas and get it executed accordingly.
Exactly, because Swami says the buddhi is the closest to the atma which you have. So he says that the buddhi is actually supposed to take commands from the atma, and as you beautifully said, the chitta becomes like a colored veil. And the more you clean it, the more clearly you see what your conscience is seeing.
So all the thing that we do via our sadhana is just cleaning of the chitta. Chitta
right.
Shuddhi.
Chitta Shuddhi. And one of the process in this chitta shuddhi is to bring good impressions. Like one thing is of course to remove it completely. There are no impressions at all. And that's what happens in surrender. And when you surrender, you are actually giving up the idea of reasoning totally. You know, what Swami says is good is good. What Swami says is bad. Can you eat egg or non-veg? What Swami says is good. What Swami says is good. Not what science says or what you think. You know, very often this argument comes like, you know, Swami says you should be non-vegetarian, but Shirdi Baba served.
Swami says you should be vegetarian.
Vegetarian, and Shirdi Baba you should serve meat. You know, these are all questions when you come when you're actually reasoning.
Jesus served fish.
Jesus served fish. And, you know, these are all come when you start reasoning. But when you say that, what does Swami say? I just follow it. You're actually, what you're doing is you're removing off a part of that reasoning abilities in your mind, or, you know, that vasanas are silently without your knowledge being sidetracked. And that's what happens during surrender.
Dear listeners, we are almost halfway through our satsang, and if, before we proceed to the very interesting part on the importance of satsang and how we do satsang, if we can just summarize what has been told till now, it is that our concept, each one of us, the first point is that each one of us is capable of distinguishing and discriminating between right and wrong, good and bad. Second point is that this ability to discriminate and identify, however, varies from individual to individual, though everyone has the same conscience, and that is because of the presence of the chitta, which is the accumulation of tendencies and impressions over lifetimes. And therefore, good, anything that we consider as good, is that which helps to purify and clean up the chitta, and thing that dirties or further pollutes the chitta is something that is bad. So, each one of us, depending on the dirt or the cleanliness of the chitta, have different concepts of good and bad. But irrespective of what our concept of good or our concept of bad is, satsang is something that helps further and intensify and enhance our own concepts of good. So therefore, for any kind of growth or progress or movement towards good, we need satsang.
In fact, I'll just give you a small example which happened in our own hostel, you know. Maybe that will give a better understanding. There was this classmate of mine, a very intelligent boy, very sincere. You know, as we initially said, when you go in as a student, what are you supposed to do as a student? He was very sincere in that sense, but the only problem was, he thought sincerity means he doing his lessons, he getting his grades, and he doing well in exams. So when somebody would come and ask him for a help, he would think that, why are they disturbing me? I'm supposed to get my good grades. I'm supposed to top the class. So he would, in a sense, refuse to help the other boys who would come to him. Okay. If you look at it, this is the conditioning with which he came. Now, this was the attitude with which he enters the hostel. But after coming, when you start seeing that helping is a norm, you know, helping a person who is not able to study well, you would see that, you know, there are boys who might sacrifice a couple of their, you know, points of grades so that somebody else who is not doing well does a little better than what he would do otherwise when you go out and help. So when he started seeing this, I think by the time he came to his final year, in fact, he completely changed his idea that even if I don't, instead of the first rank, if I'm going to get the third rank, and a friend of mine can clear the exams, I mean, it's definitely worth it. It's more than worth it. You know, that attitude change comes when your conditioning is slowly changing. You know, you are in the company of people who all think in a certain manner, who all think it is good to help others, who all think that it is okay if I can sacrifice a few points of my grade and help somebody else. So automatically you know, your idea and your conditioning is slowly changing without your knowledge.
This
is what in a chitta, in good company does.
In a discourse, I was just amplifying the same thing what you said. In a discourse, Bhagwan mentioned how every one of us, if every being is like a car on a journey to reach the final goal. And satsang, or Swami would often use it in terms of sankirtan also, or singing as a group, instead of doing individual singing, which can easily be extrapolated to working in a group rather than individual. Swami would say, imagine there are 100 cars going on that highway. It's dark outside, and that darkness is the darkness of ignorance. Ajnana timirandasya, when they say. So in that darkness, you need light. So each car puts on the individual headlight, and therefore the road is illumined and all the cars are headed towards the destination. Now in this scenario, just imagine if one of the cars has a breakdown and the headlights just turn off. There is no problem, because the car can still manage in the light of the 99 other cars. And that is the power of satsang or good company. The light of others can help to show you your own path. If you had been a solo car on the road and your headlights break down, that's it, you have to stop and your progress halts there. And that is why satsang enthuses each one of us. We have felt it so many times when we are feeling personally low in our life, when we are feeling down, we just go and attend possibly a talk, or we have a discussion, or we read a book. You know, a book can also be a good company. And we see our spirits returning. What actually is happening is the goodness, the positivity, the enthusiasm that is present in someone else or something else is getting rubbed on to us and making us back, getting us recharged back. So definitely satsang helps in a big way.
Very true. But you know, even as we spoke, it's much more important, satsang is much more important than in daily life of goodness and badness. And for a spiritual aspirant, satsang has a completely new meaning, but that will be the later part of the satsang. But before we go to that, I think we should play out that discourse clip where Swami speaks of the importance of satsang.
Exactly.
And he says, you know, in how many levels this is an important habit to have.
You may put a question, how can I meet, see God?
Pichivada.
Oh, madcap.
భగవంతుని వేరే దర్శించనక్కర్లేదు.
యూ డోంట్ నీడ్ టు సీ గాడ్ సెపరేట్లీ.
ఎక్కడ చూసినా భగవంతుడే.
యూ ఫైండ్ గాడ్ ఎవ్రీవేర్.
ఏ వస్తువునందు చూసినా భగవంతుడే.
గాడ్ ఈజ్ ఇన్ ఎవ్రీ ఆబ్జెక్ట్.
నీవు దేనిని చూస్తున్నావో అది భగవంతుడే.
వాట్ ఎవర్ దట్ యు సీ ఈజ్ డివైన్.
ప్రతి వ్యక్తి కూడాను ప్రతి పదార్థం కూడాను మీ యందు రిఫ్లెక్షన్ అయ్యేటువంటివి.
దేర్ఫోర్ ఎవ్రీ పర్సన్ ఎవ్రీ ఆబ్జెక్ట్ ఈజ్ యువర్ ఓన్ రిఫ్లెక్షన్.
కొన్ని దానికి వియోగం వస్తుంది, కొన్ని దానికి సంయోగం వస్తుంది.
దేర్ మే బి ఏ కైండ్ ఆఫ్ యూనియన్ ఆర్ సెపరేషన్.
సంయోగ వియోగ సంకర్షమాత్మక తరంగమైన ఉదాహరణమే ఈ యొక్క సముద్రము.
దేర్ఫోర్ ఇట్ ఈస్ ది సంయోగ యూనియన్, ఇట్ ఈస్ వియోగ ద సెపరేషన్. వియోగ సెపరేషన్,
వియోగం జరుగుతుంటుంది.
The separation happens.
సంయోగం వస్తుంటుంది.
And also unity.
సంయోగ వియోగ సమత్వమైనటువంటి ఒక తత్వమే ఏకత్వము.
Therefore that oneness is beyond this union and separation.
ఈ రెండింటిని ఏకత్వంగా తీసుకోవాలి.
And we should go by only one principle.
నాకు వియోగమే లేదు.
There is no separation.
నాకు సంయోగమే లేదు.
No samyoga union.
సంయోగం ఉంటే కదా వియోగం వస్తుంది.
If there is samyoga union, there will be vyoga separation.
భ్రమలే కాని వేరు కాదు.
It's all your imagination.
నిజంగా ఆత్మతత్వాన్ని గుర్తించవలసినటువంటి వారు.
Those who want to know the self atma,
ekam sat tane matrame manam drushtilo pettukovali,
should always keep in view sat is only one.
Rendovadi kane kaadu.
The second doesn't exist.
Maatma chendede kaadu.
It doesn't change.
Sarvakala sarvavastare endu kodanu ekangane untadi.
In all positions, in all periods of time, it remains as one entity.
Atti ekatvanni manam gurtinchukovadaniki taginatvanti satsangam cheyali.
Therefore we should join this satsanga.
Anaga ee moodinti yokka tattvanni manam gurtinchali.
We have to recognize and experience this oneness.
Manam chuchedi,
we see,
మనం వినేది,
ఆల్ దట్ వి హియర్,
మనం చేసేది,
ఆల్ దట్ వి డు,
మూడింటి యొక్క ఏకత్వం కావాలి మనకు.
రిక్వైర్స్ హార్మనీ ఆఫ్ ది యూనిటీ.
మూడింటి యొక్క ఏకత్వమే నిజమైన సత్సంగము.
వెల్, స్వామి మేక్స్ ఇట్ సో క్లియర్. హీ సేస్ దట్ వన్ హూ ఇస్ నాట్ ఎఫెక్టెడ్ బై యూనియన్ ఆర్ సెపరేషన్, బేసికలీ ద డ్యూయాలిటీస్ ఆఫ్ లైఫ్, ఈజ్ వన్ హూ హెస్ అచీవ్డ్ ది అల్టిమేట్ ఆఫ్ లైఫ్, the ultimate goal of life. He is a true spiritual aspirant, and for such a spiritual aspirant, Swami says satsanga is very important. In short, Swami says that to achieve the ultimate purpose or the ultimate goal in life, satsang is of paramount importance. That is one definition. That is how Swami highlights the importance of satsang. And after that, Swami also gives a very, very interesting definition of satsang, another definition. We first thought satsang means a good talk or a good discussion. Then we came to satsang meaning good company. And now Swami says satsang is having unity in thought, word and deed, where what you think is the same as what you speak, is the same as what you do, and all three are noble and pure. It is not that you think bad, speak bad and do bad. It is, they have to be Trikarna Shuddhi, that is purity of these three. And oneness of these three is satsang, where the thoughts are in company of the words, are in company of the deeds that we do. I think that is another very unique and innovative interpretation. I mean, it is not an interpretation, it is the meaning of satsang.
If going, we are talking of satsang as something which is external. What Swami has done in this clip is he's saying that it is something much more subtler than even an external company. Because even if we look at our own minds and our own thoughts, all of us have good thoughts, bad thoughts, you know, right thoughts and wrong thoughts, or let's say that which is pleasant and that which is unpleasant. I think satsang could also mean the ability to stick to those thoughts which are good. In fact, if we look at it, one of the things which Swami used to tell is, a thought is spontaneous. Most often you look at somebody, you like him or you don't like him. Your anger is so spontaneous. It doesn't wait for your mind to discriminate and then throw out that feeling or that thought. But what you have is the ability to counter that with a good thought. Do you have the strength to, you know, every time a bad thought arises, do you have the ability to counter it with a strong, powerful, positive thought? And Swami would often say that is what you have to do, and Swami would give many examples of how, you know, there is nobody who is good all the time. You know, a great man is just a man who catches himself every time he becomes a jerk. That's what one of the Zen masters says. That every time I do a mistake, I know I've done a mistake, I catch myself and I stalk myself.
When you said this, Prem, I was reminded of something that happened just 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot say that this is what happens every time, but this was definitely an eye-opening experience for me. I was forced to wait for something for which I was not supposed to wait.
Mm-hmm.
And something that should have got done in 5 minutes took more than 40 minutes. And by the end of 20-25 minutes, I was starting to get really irritated because for no fault of mine, my time was being wasted. And even as I started getting irritated, my rational self is telling me that your irritation is not affecting the other party in any way. It was actually me waiting for a train.
Okay.
And the train was delayed by more than an hour. And there was no reason why it should have been delayed like that, because it was just starting a few stations away. So why would a train be so delayed within such a less time? That was what irritated me actually. And then me getting irritated, how does it help the train? So this was what the logical mind was telling me, the rational mind that was telling me that there's no use of getting irritated because it doesn't help the train. But you know, Prem, at such times, logic doesn't work. I know that me getting irritated doesn't help the train come faster, but I'm just irritated. I can't help it. I'm getting more and more irritated. And that is when I just sat and I thought, okay, let me imagine one beautiful moment that happened to me personally during darshan. And I sat there and started playing it out in as much detail as I could. You know, Swami coming out, how he was looking, what robe he was wearing, when I saw his feet, what happened. The whole episode. And it took me almost 12 minutes to play this out in my mind's eye. At the end of it, Prem, I was feeling so wonderful, so nice. And actually thankful for this wait. Because for me, it was almost as if I had had Swami's darshan. And I would not have had this kind of a darshan and joy if not for the train being late. So when you said that we can replace it with a good thought, I feel it's a very practical and very important suggestion, and we should definitely keep trying it more often. Anytime we get angry, anytime we are irritated, anytime we are sad, replace a sad thought, angry thought, irritated or frustrated thought with a thought that is beautiful. And what more beautiful thought than the thought of Swami? Replace it with thought of Swami. And dear listeners, you can try it out. It's a matter of 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, the entire situation will change for the better, for the best.
But you know, having said that, it doesn't happen all the time. We're not able to do that.
Mm.
You know, because it, in a sense, it requires a lot of personal control to do that. You know, to stop yourself and say that, no, I want to think positively. No, I want to think of good things. And that is where actually satsang helps. You know, if you look at it, I was just reading, where we had a satsang on addictions and habits and all that. There are many addictions which you can stop yourself. Like, let's say you're addicted to watching too much of TV or you're addicted to playing games. With a conscious effort, you can actually wean yourself away from those habits. But there are some addictions which cannot get away from them just by personal effort. I think one of those is substance abuse. You know, when they say, and if you actually read the science behind substance abuse and the addiction which comes to drugs which are, you know, banned, it actually happens in a much more subtle level and which actually takes the control completely away from you.
It happens at a biochemical level.
Right. In fact, biochemical starts at a biochemical level, which ends up in a neurological change.
Exactly.
Which means your brain physically changes. You know, your brain completely changes. It gets hardwired in your brain that you need that substance to live.
To get joy. You are happy only when you have that substance.
Actually, it actually goes beyond the state of happiness. To remain normal, to remain yourself, you need to take those drugs. And that happens in a very subtle level, and they say that at that point you cannot help yourself. You cannot decide that I'm going to stop taking this. And that's when you need somebody who is outside you and who knows what's the process which has happened and who is able to walk you back that same path. And that's why they say they slowly wean you away from that, you know, that habit. And that's why when we talk of satsang, when we spoke about the effect of chitta, there are some impressions which are so deeply engraved in us. Simple things like, you know, I need to fend for myself. This is a dog-eat-dog world. If I don't grab for myself, I cannot take care of myself. You know, this is a thought which has got hardwired in our brain with so many lifetimes. And if this has to be removed, this has to be removed by an external agency. I think that also explains why God comes down as an avatar. You know, you talk of conscience and that conscience being God. Why should God come down as an avatar? Because I think at some point you need that external agency to come and stop you from what you're doing, turn you back, and actually bring you back to what you really are. And that's what a divine personage or an avatar actually does to you. And that's what good company actually does to you.
Now here comes another question. Of course, the avatar, we keep avatar out of this, for this question. If not the avatar, as it is said, you see good company. Now the question is, if everyone seeks satsang, if everyone seeks good company, what about the transformation of those who are bad? In the sense, like if somebody is bad and wants to transform himself or herself and therefore is seeking good company, why will the other person reciprocate and seek this person's company? Because everybody is seeking good company, right? So when you say good, let us say there are levels of good. You know, you can have levels of bad. For Swami
says always have bad company and... I'm sorry, you always have good company and run away from bad company.
Huh.
So if everybody who is running away from bad company, then there's no way I can go and have a good company with anybody.
Prem, actually, if you think a little deeper, everybody will be running away from everyone.
Right.
For example, because your concept of good and bad is different from mine, and we have discussed why it is different, and therefore, the nobler of the two will run away from the other, and since there is nobody who is equal in the world, everybody is nobler or less noble than the other, everybody is running away from everyone.
Right.
It's almost like friendship can happen only between equals, and there are no equals in the world because everyone is different. So
the bad will keep company with the bad, the good will keep company with the good.
No. There also, they're relative, you know.
Right.
When I say that I want to be, say for example, a saint, mm-hmm. I want to be with the saint. Why will the saint want to be with me? Because I'm bad company for him. So the saint will want to be with someone who is above him. And if he wants to be with someone who is above him, why will that person want to be with him? Because he is bad company. So in this sense, I'm saying since none of us are equal in our goodness, everyone is slightly different, it almost is like if we seek good company, then we can have no company.
Just a light-hearted digression. You know, I remember once when Swami was in Vrindavan, I think it was during the vacations, or... Inimical Professor Anil Kumar was sitting there, and Swami walked up to him, and suddenly out of the blue, you know, Swami stopped there, looked at him, and he said, "Who is the luckiest person in the world?" And he suddenly, I mean, Swami is giving darshan, and he just stops and looks at Anil Kumar and says, "Who is the luckiest person in the whole world?"
Hmm.
He said, "Swami, it's me."
Hmm.
Swami said, "Why?" "Because so many people are sitting here, Swami is coming for darshan, Swami is stopping and talking to me, so I am the luckiest person right now in the world." And Swami was very happy with the answer. And Swami said, "Who is the most unluckiest person in the world?" And without batting an eyelid, he said, "Swami, you. Because you are talking to me." You know, in the sense, like, as you said, if everybody is going to run away from bad company, I don't think Swami would have come to be a part of, you know, to have us as his company, isn't it?
In this light-hearted banter, Prem, we have actually stumbled upon one magnificent truth. You know, he said that if each one is different, each one is different in each one's goodness level, it's almost as if advising to seek good company is like advising to seek no company, because there's no one who is equal. And if we see the stanza from the Bhajagovindam by Adi Shankaracharya, I think it is the ninth, he has written 13 verses, in that the ninth verse, there he speaks about satsang. He says, satsangatve nisangatvam. He says, good satsang is that, good company is that which leads you to no company. Not in the sense that we discussed in our light-hearted banter, but this shloka, this stanza from the Bhajagovindam is something very profound, and I think we should take it up in this discussion on satsang. So, he says, satsangatve nisangatvam, nisangatve nirmohatvam, nirmohatve nischalatatvam, nichalatatve jivan mukti. Before we take this up, dear listeners, I think this would be a wonderful point to stop. and hear our beloved Bhagwan singing this very stanza from the Bhaja Govindam.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Satsangate, nisangatam, nisangate, nirmohatam.
Satsangate,
Nishchalatattva, Jeevan Mukti.
Nirmohatve, Nishchalatattva, Jeevan Mukti.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
As you rightly reminded me, Prem, that there is a beautiful answer that Swami has given to the question, if everyone seeks satsang, what about transformation of the bad? So, dear listeners, before we go into the shloka from the Bhagavad, from the Bhaja Govindam that we heard Swami singing so beautifully and melodiously just now, I think, Prem, yeah, you should share with all our listeners and all of us the answer that Swami gives.
Right. In fact, it does actually come out from this very verse which Shankaracharya has written. Mm. It just goes to say what a brilliant person Adi Shankara was. Mm. He was able to decode so many things for us, and he put it in such simple language, in the sense that after so many hundred years, we still can look back at it and learn lessons from it.
Mm.
A perfect analogy which Swami used to give is, when you have a sapling and you put it in the roadside when you want it to grow, one of the greatest dangers that sapling has is the stray cattle which is going around, which would come and eat it off.
So especially would say, in countries like India.
Especially in countries like India. I'm sure some of the Western countries or Scandinavian countries must
be wondering what
is that.
In India, we have a lot of stray cattle, and I think it is the country with possibly the largest stray cattle population. And most of the time when we have tree planting drives, you will plant about 5,000 trees and about 1,500 will be eaten in their young childhood itself, right? Because these wandering cattle just gulp them up.
Exactly. So what Swami would say is, when you plant a sapling like that on the roadside, what they do is, even now it's a practice, they put a small fence only for that one plant. A fence is put for that one plant. And when you do that, you put it till a point where the sapling actually outgrows that fence you have put. It grows so large that most often you would see that fence is broken off, or
exactly,
the corporation comes and removes that fence for another sapling which is to be planted. But it goes to such a state where this small sapling, which was endangered by those stray cattle, grows so large that that same stray cattle can now come and sit under the shade of that tree.
Hmm.
Swami would say, this is what happens when you go through the process of satsang, where you need satsang for that goodness initially to protect yourself. You know, it's almost like a protective fence.
Protect
and grow. But you grow to a certain extent, that very same elements which were a danger for your goodness now will come and seek you as good company. And that is why, in fact, what Shankara says, satsangatve nissangatvam, means from that point where your goodness needs satsang, you have to graduate to that point where your goodness stands alone. Even in the absence of sangam, nissangatve, even in the absence of any kind of company, you remain good, because that goodness becomes a nature now.
If we see the term nissangatvam, nissangatvam means absence of company. It is almost as if the great Adi Shankaracharya is also defining he's defining what satsang should actually do.
Right.
Satsang is that which leads you to nissanga. Nissanga meaning absence of company, which means satsang should lead you away from attachment. I often think, like, when I was reading this prema, I was just thinking, if, for example, we have afternoon satsang regularly, and after 10 years, somebody says, can you speak something about Swami's childhood? If I say, I just cannot, if prema is here, I can, and if prema is not there, I just cannot, I can't do a satsang without him, then I feel all our afternoon satsang is not actually a satsang, because it has led to dependency and attachment. Nissangatvam meaning, it means independence, and as Swami would define, independence is independence. Dependence on what is within. And therefore, there is no more need for anything external, just like the tree that grew so much that it doesn't need, nor is it endangered by anything else. In the same way, satsang is that which leads us to become completely independent, depending on what is within, and we know what is within. It is the Atmic principle or God.
Yeah, I remember one of our teachers was describing to us, you know, I think it was Shailesh sir, if I'm not wrong. He was describing one particular episode which happened in his life. He was in the library just going through a few books. He was browsing through a certain number of books, where he found this book, which was actually an entire book talking of the absence of God, proving in a scientific manner that there cannot be an entity called God.
Hmm.
Okay, and we all know Shailesh sir is a brilliant physicist, very, very analytical, and is a brilliant researcher too.
Hmm.
So casually going through that book, he said that big deal, I can go through this book and I can scientifically prove that whatever he's saying is wrong and God is there. Okay, so he sat with that book, he said, mentally he told himself, I'm going to go through this book and I'm going to point by point prove to myself that what he has written is wrong.
Hmm.
Okay, and even as he was reading that book, he found that the logic which was presented in that book was so strong that he was beginning to shake.
Hmm.
And you know, he was a little, shaken up, and he felt so restless after reading that book, and he went back to Mandir in that same emotion, and Swami just walks up to him and gives him a good, blasting, saying that don't overestimate yourself. You know, that is why keeping good company is good. Because it is not that, what happens is, suppose some situation like this, your faith now depends on the ability of the other person to argue well. You know, if you have a friend who is very good at arguing, and if he is a person who has faith in God, so now your faith in God will depend on that person's ability to argue well. So if you encounter a person who is a very good arguer, and he is an atheist, so now your faith will depend on that person's ability to argue. So that is why satsang is that which with slow time, passage of time, will take you to a state where it doesn't depend on any factor which is external, but depends only on internal factors. And that is why it has to lead to nisangam.
And this is what I think Swami so beautifully elaborates and emphasizes and gives an entirely new dimension to the term satsang. Till now we have evolved from satsang being a talk or a discourse or a discussion to satsang being good company. From there, thanks to Bhagwan, we evolved to satsang being unity in our thought, word and deeds. But now, I think this is the crux of our whole satsang here, where Swami defines what satsang actually is. I think we'll listen to that piece from Bhagwan's discourse, which was delivered on the 3rd of March. The 1st of March 2003,
right.
Shivratri discourse.
Right.
You may put a question, how can I meet, see God?
Pichivada.
Oh, madcap.
Bhagavantuni vere darshinchanakkarledu.
You don't need to see God separately.
Ekkada chusina Bhagavantude.
You find God everywhere.
ఏ వస్తువునందు చూచినా భగవంతుడే.
గాడ్ ఈజ్ ఇన్ ఎవ్రీ ఆబ్జెక్ట్.
నీవు దేనిని చూస్తున్నావో అది భగవంతుడే.
వాట్ ఎవర్ దట్ యు సీ ఈజ్ డివైన్.
దేనిని అనుభవిస్తున్నావో అది భగవంతుడే.
వాట్ ఆల్ దట్ యు ఎక్స్పీరియన్స్ ఈజ్ ఆల్సో డివైన్.
దేని నీవు ఆనందిస్తున్నావో అది భగవంతుడే.
దట్ వాట్ యు అట్రాక్ట్ ఈజ్ ఆల్సో డివైన్.
కనుకనే నీవు దర్శించినదంతా దైవత్వమే.
Therefore, what all you, that you visualize is divine. You don't have to see God separately. You are God. And God is yourself only.
కనుకని నేను దైవం, దైవమే నేను అనేటువంటి వేదము ప్రబోధిస్తూ వచ్చింది.
Veda goes on declaring this fact that I am God and God is none else other than the self.
లోకములో పేర్లు ఎన్నైనా ఉన్నాయి కానీ దైవం ఒక్కడే.
There may be very nomenclature, but God is one only.
ఇలాంటి దైవత్వం అనేటువంటి ఏకత్వాన్ని మనం గుర్తించాలి.
We have to recognize the basic unity, oneness of divinity.
దేనిని చూసినా ఇది దైవమే.
Whatever that may you may see is God only.
దేనిని అందుకున్నా అది దైవమే.
All that you receive is only God.
దేనిని మనం భుజించినా అది దైవమే.
All that you partake is also divine.
కనుకనే సర్వం కలివిదం బ్రహ్మ అన్నాడు.
Therefore it is said the whole thing
అనేక రకములుగా ఉన్నప్పటికీ అది ఏకత్వంగానే ఉంటుండాలి.
It may seem to be plurality and multiplicity, but it is only one.
అట్టి ఆత్మతత్వమే నీ ఎందే ఉంటున్నది.
That principle of self is in you.
కనుక ఏకం సత్ అన్నారు.
Therefore it is said truth is one.
సత్సంగం అనగా ఏకమే కాని అనేకలతో కూడినటువంటిది కాదు.
సో సత్సంగం meant identification with that oneness.
ఇలాంటి పవిత్రమైనటువంటి ఒక సంగమను మనం ఏర్పాటు చేసుకోవాలి.
We should have that sacred company sangha.
ఈనాడు సత్సంగం అనగా 10 మంది ఆధ్యాత్మిక సాధకులు చేరినప్పుడు అది సత్సంగం అనుకుంటున్నాం.
Today we go by the meaning for this word satsanga, to join the company of good saints.
అలాంటి వారి కంపెనీతో చేరినప్పుడు మనం కూడా సత్సంగంగానే భావిస్తున్నాం.
We also consider ourselves a member of good
company. కానీ ఆ సంఘం కూడాను మార్పు చెందేది కానీ స్థిరమైనటువంటిది కాదు.
Even the satsanga good company, what we think also
ఎందుకనగా you may tell who is good, ఎవరి నీవు గుడ్ అనుకుంటున్నావో వాడు నీకు బ్యాడ్ అవుతున్నాడు.
Because the one whom you consider good all of a sudden transforms into bad one.
వాళ్ళతో నీవు చేరేటప్పటికి నీవు కూడా మంచి చెడ్డనుగా మారిపోతున్నావు.
When once you join his company, you may turn good or bad.
ఇవన్నీ అస్థిరమైనటువంటి వస్తువులే.
These are all temporary objects.
ఇదంతా అస్థిరమైనటువంటి జీవులే.
They are all ephemeral beings.
అశాశ్వతమైనటువంటి సంబంధములే.
It's only temporary understanding.
అస్థిరమైనటువంటి దానికి శాశ్వతమైనటువంటి ఆనందాన్ని ఎట్లా అందిస్తుంది?
That which is temporary cannot confer permanent bliss.
కనుక ఇది అసాధ్యము.
It is impossible.
కనుక ఇది అసాధ్యమైనటువంటి తత్వాన్ని మనము సత్సంగంగా భావించుకోవటం చేతనే ఈనాటి వరకు కూడాను మనము ఈ సత్సంగ ప్రభావాన్ని గుర్తించుకోలేకపోతున్నాము.
Because we want to get that which is impossible, we have not able to understand and reap the benefits of satsanga.
Tell me your company, I shall tell you what you are. Ani.
It is said, tell me your company, I shall tell you what you are.
Ni anityamainatu varito sneham chesinappudu aa anityamainatu sambandhame neeku praptisthundi.
Association with the momentary will confer ephemeral results only.
Nitya satyamainatu danito neevu friendship cheyali.
You should have friendship with that permanent and eternal.
ఆ నిత్య సత్యమైనటువంటి ఒక ప్రాప్తి నీయందే ఉన్నది కానీ బయట ప్రపంచంలో కానరాదు.
That one which is eternal entity reality is within you.
ఈ జగత్ అంతయకును మార్పు చెందేటువంటిది.
The whole world is bound to change.
అన్ని పదార్థముల యొక్క చేరికనే.
It's all the combination of
ఈ పదార్థములు ఎలాంటివి అనగా అస్థిరమైనటువంటి పదార్థములే.
The matter that you find in the world is only temporary.
సత్యనిత్యమైనటువంటి పదార్థములు ఈ జగత్తులో మనకు కానరాదు.
In this world, you don't find anything that's permanent and eternal. This is all full of name and form which is temporary. That which is unmanifest is within you.
I think Swami made so many points in that clip, which in that 5 minutes Swami covered much more than we could cover in 50, 55 minutes of our discussion. But you know, some of those points that Swami made was really, we are nobody to say that it was brilliant, but it really opened our eyes to a lot of things in there. Because one thing which maybe we missed out when we started by saying that, you know, you just make a list of what is good and bad for you that time. And keep the company of those who encourage you to do that good. Is a point which we left out, which Swami actually pointed out now, is that our concept of good is actually an evolving concept. You know, at any point in time, what we think is good and bad is something which is improving and changing and evolving for the better all the time. So that is why when you say that, when Swami says that true sat is that which is inside, you know, don't try it and don't seek the company of what you think is good, but seek the company of what is always good. Because what you choose or what you consider as good may somewhere down the line become bad or might not be as good as you actually thought it to be.
And in fact, Swami defines satsang, sat being the ultimate truth, which is that everything is divine. And Swami, that is what he emphasized in the first part of the clip, that whatever you see is God, there is nothing else other than God, everything is God, sarvam kalvidam brahma. And this is the only truth, and that's why Swami said it as ekam sat. There's only one truth. And that truth, that is ekam sat, Swami said. And in satsang, in the word satsang, the first word sat refers to this truth. So being in sangha of this truth, being in company of this truth that everything is divine, I think that could be the best possible thumb rule for us to define satsang. Anything that leads us or further enhances our conviction that everything is divine, anything that enhances this thought or anything that gives rise to such feelings and thoughts that everything is divine, every person I see, everything that I see is divine, that is satsang. And anything that takes us towards diversity, makes us feel that things are different, anything that makes us feel different from the others and takes us away from unity is not good sangha, it is dussangha, not satsangha. So satsangha is that which takes us towards unity of creation, the ability to see the one God pervading everything, and dussangha is that which takes us towards differentiation in creation that makes us break it down into separate entities.
Just playing the devil's advocate, you know, people might ask, the real true good company is Swami himself. You know, as you said, that sometimes some people might appear good, but later they might become bad. But one person whom we are all sure is really good company is Swami. But you don't see that everybody who lived in Swami's company really shines forth with that goodness. Sometimes it doesn't happen. You know, let's talk about ourselves rather than pointing to anybody else. I think I am not the perfect good I would like to be, even though I've spent so many years with Swami. So doesn't that actually speak of a drawback in satsangam? Satsang does not actually give you the ultimate. I think even that answer lies in this statement where you say satsangatve nissangatvam. You know, when you live with Swami and you think that he is good company, you're thinking of Swami as a person whom you're living with. I think that is the limitation of satsang. That satsang has to reach the state where I am not living with another person. You know, if you're sitting with Swami and if you feel that I'm sitting with another person, it remains satsang, but that satsang, when it transforms to nissangatve, I'm sitting in the presence of my own self, I think that is when the progression actually happens.
In fact, again, I would like to, you know, remind our listeners of that beautiful discourse during the 1975 birthday celebrations, the Golden Jubilee birthday celebrations of Bhagwan, which has actually been made into a beautiful DVD-CD combination. In that discourse, Bhagwan reveals and he says, there's only one God. He is omnipresent. He is Satya Sai. And everybody claps because it is like a, you know, a kind of statement where Swami is saying about himself. But then Swami immediately says that you're all clapping because you think Satya Sai is this 5 foot frame here. Swami then says Satya Sai is one who is Satya Shai, one who is lying on Satya, One who rests on Satya is Satya Sai. And what is that Satya? And Swami says, Satya is that which is Trikala Badhyam, which is the same in all three periods in time, which is the same for everyone, and that Satya is that everything is divine. And Swami says, Satya Sai is that truth. And therefore, when you ask this question, you only answered the question that you asked as the devil's advocate, but the answer that popped in my mind is Satya Sai is not that 5'2" frame, and just being close doesn't matter. We have to imbibe what Satya Sai truly is, which is this truth. And that Swami would often say, you know, you are all like frogs hopping around a lotus. They do not benefit in any way from the lotus. Who benefit is actually the bees. Though they might physically be very far away, they come from that distance, take the honey, the sweet nectar that is there in the lotus and fly away. And so, it is not nearness, physical proximity that matters. It is the dearness. And dearness, who is dear to Swami? Swami says, one who follows Swami's teachings is dear to Swami. And therefore, when we say we are in the company of Swami, it means that we are living His teachings every moment of our lives.
I think it again comes to that empowered choice. You know, when you give the analogy of a frog and the bee, you know, the frog might be next to the lotus by means of a chance, you know, occurrence. It's just that it happened to be born in the pond where there is this beautiful lotus. But the bee comes in search of it. The bee has made that conscious choice that I want something which the lotus has. I think that is why satsangam is so important, because it's all about the choice that you make. That you have decided that I know there is good and bad. I may or may not be able to follow the good, but I want to follow the good. I want to do something so that I follow the good. And that's when you gravitate towards satsang.
And we spoke about nissanga. The shloka goes, nissangatve nirmohatvam. Nirmohatvam means the destruction of delusion. Just one beautiful example again, which was given in response to a question that was posed to Professor G. Venkatraman. It was such a beautiful answer. I'm reminded of it now. You know, what is meant by this loss of delusion? Somebody asked this very interesting question as to what is the difference between loneliness and solitude? Because in both, you are alone, right? You are alone, and right. What is it that makes it solitude? What is it that makes it loneliness? And pat came the professor's reply. He said, Atmabhimanam is solitude, Dehabhimanam is loneliness. And he further elaborated. He said, Dehabhimanam is when you identify yourself as separate from others. And that, you know, is what Swami defines as anything that leads you to that is actually dussanga, bad company, which leads you to body identification as you as separate. When you identify yourself separate from others, when you are sitting by yourself, you feel that there is no one else here, everyone is away from you and you are alone. Then you feel lonely. But when you have Atmabhimanam, when you identify with your true self and you realize that everyone is part of the same divinity, then how can you ever be anything other than alone? Because you alone exist. There is only God and nothing else. And therefore, whether you are in the company of 10 bodies or whether you are in the company of your own body, it is just the same, because there is only one. And therefore, it becomes solitude. And this thing that makes us see diversity in the underlying unity is called maya or delusion. And satsangam leads to nissangam, and nissangam leads to nirmoham, where this delusion is gone and we are able to see the unity of the entire creation. And this nirmoham, Shankaracharya says, leads to nischala tattvam.
No, the interesting thing is, as we said, so beautifully Adi Shankara has written this, because when you ask this question, if satsangam is supposed to lead to nisangatve, then why not I be alone? Why not I be to myself? You can be to yourself if you are self-contained. You know, that is why it is said that nisangatve nirmohatvam. If you are able to be happy without the need for company, if you are able to be happy without the need for anything, where attachment is not a necessity for you to be happy, then you are entitled to be alone and to be happy. You don't need satsangam. And the other thing is, nirmohatve nischala tattvam. And that means, chalam means that which is wavering, that fickle. Which is fickle. So nischala tattvam is when you are in a steady and stable state of mind. So if you're alone, and if you feel calm and peaceful by yourself, then you're in solitude. But if you're alone and if you feel restless, then you're not in solitude, but you're in loneliness. And that's why it said that the nissangam finally will have to lead to the state of nischala tattvam.
It is so beautiful because on one hand, it is not only the effect is shown, the cause is also shown. I mean,
right.
On one hand, we think it is only a causal shloka where we say that satsanga.
This leads to that.
It is also the effect also which says that it is true satsanga only if it leads to nissanga. It is true nissanga only if it leads to nirmoha. It is true nirmoha only if it leads to nischala tattva, which Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says is the most dear to me. He says to Arjuna that one who is equanimous in sukha dukke samay kritva labha labho jaya jayo, in profit and loss, in gain and in happiness and in sorrow, one who is equanimous is the one who is dear to me. And Adi Shankara then says the final statement of that shloka where he says, this nischala tattvam, this equanimity is what leads one to jivan mukti or the ultimate liberation. So going through this shloka, we realize that it all begins with satsang.
And I think that is where this satsang ends, where it all begins. Because dear listeners, we've come to the end of our time, but I think as Swami said, none of us have really understood the importance satsang plays in our life and in our journey towards our ultimate goal. But I think it is our good fortune that we have, you know, something like technology also aiding us to have satsang. That, you know, you could just sit whichever part of the world you are in and tune in, not only to this, you know, anything. I mean, I always would suggest that at the click of a button, you can listen to Swami's voice. What can be greater than that? What can
or you can read, or you can listen to the horrible things happening in the world. That is where the choice comes. That is where we choose what kind of company we have to keep. Before we conclude, dear listeners, just those two thumb rules that we derived. One is, satsang is that, see, for us, the ultimate Atma or God is Swami. So we use these terms interchangeably, whether Atma, unity or Swami, we use it interchangeably, and therefore satsang is that which leads us closer towards this unity, or that leads us closer towards seeing God in everything in the world, or that leads us closer to Swami. Anything that leads us closer to that, be it our friend, be it a small kitten that we see, anything that leads us, be it a book, be it a music piece, anything that leads us towards this is satsang. That is what we have to run behind. And what we have to leave away is anything that leads us away from Swami or thoughts of Swami. Anything that leads us away, leads us into thinking that God pervades everything. If we think that, if we get angry on someone, it is obvious that we do not believe in God existing in everyone. And therefore, anything that leads us away from this is dussanga. So these are the two thumb rules for us to identify satsang and dussang.
And if you have any thoughts on the discussion we've had here today, you can send us your feedback at listener@radiosai.org. And dear listeners, going by the tradition we have followed, next week we are supposed to take up the Ramakatha Rasvahini, but we just would like to inform you that we won't be doing that because next Thursday is a very special day, because
it's Christmas.
It's Christmas. Christmas is falling on a Thursday, and New Year too is falling on a Thursday. So I think it would be apt if our discussion centers around these two themes. And that would mean that we cannot take up Ramakatha Rasvahini in the fortnight to follow. So we do hope you'll join us next week on a satsang which will be centered on the faith of Christianity. We'll do hope. We have not yet decided what we're going to talk to you about, but we hope that Swami is going to fill us with the thoughts which he would like us to share with you.
And along with Swami, we request you too to fill us with thoughts and feelings that you would like. You can do so. While Swami can do it by directly planting those into our heads or into our hearts, you would have to go to a computer and type down a mail to listener@radiosai.org. You can do that. We end this satsang offering our most humble gratitude at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, who is ever present with us always in our life. We will end with this song, the other side of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
Man mero lage na tere bina sahi, man mero lage na tere.
आई दर्शन के प्यासे अखिया तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी जीवन ज्योत जला साई मेरे जीवन ज्योत जला साई मेरे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे लागे ना तेरे बिना रे छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले नयन कमल मन मोहक मादक रंजित है अधरा रे तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले इस छवि को हम मन में भर कर तेरे गुण को गाए तेरे गुण को गाए मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना